Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi there, and welcome to Comedy Album Book Club, the podcast in which we listen to an influential, loved, hated, or rarely heard comedy album, and then talk about it with comedians and comedy nerds. I'm your host, Jason DeLine, an actor and comedy enthusiast. In this episode, we discuss George Carlin's album, Class Clown, his third of 20. We recommend listening to the album before listening to the rest of this episode. It was recorded on May 27th, 1972 at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium in Santa Monica, California, and released later that year in September. George Dennis Patrick Carlin was born on May 12th, 1937 in Manhattan, New York. When he was 2 months old, his parents separated because of his father's alcoholism. Expelled from high school, he joined the Air Force, where he was court-martialed 3 times and discharged in 1957 at the age of 20. 2 years later, while working as a DJ at a radio station in Texas, Carlin met Jack Burns, with whom he recorded the comedy album Burns and Carlin at the Playboy Club Tonight in 1960. Carlin went on to hone his comedy and appeared on various TV shows as characters such as the Indian Sergeant and Al Sleet, the Hippy Dippy Weatherman. In 1967, Carlin put out his first solo album, Takeoffs and Put-Ons, followed by the very popular FM AM in 1972. His most famous bit, The 7 Words You Can Never Say on Television, was recorded for Class Clown. Carlin was arrested for performing this routine in 1972. Carlin became synonymous with hippies and counterculture as he pushed the limits of comedy and put a lens on not just everyday life, but on the establishment. Many modern comedians cite Carlin as an influence, noting that he was so prolific that he covered almost every topic imaginable. Carlin hosted the premiere episode of Saturday Night Live in 1975, hosting a second time in 1984. He appeared in various films and TV series and made several specials for HBO. In 2001, he won a Lifetime Achievement Award at the 15th Annual American Comedy Awards. After a series of heart attacks and being treated for drug addiction, Carlin died of heart failure in 2008 at the age of 71, 1 week after his last performance in Las Vegas. As per his request, his ashes were spread in front of various New York nightclubs he performed in and over Spofford Lake in New Hampshire, where he spent many summers attending camp as a child. Considered by many to be the most influential and possibly best comedian of all time, no conversation about comedy is complete without mentioning George Carlin. Today we're joined by our producer and comedy nerd, Matthew Ardill.
Hey.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Comedian Jim McAleese. How are you, Jim?
I am president.
Great. Good to hear. Congratulations.
Wow. I thought we were doing attendance.
Good. We've had an upgrade, folks. This just in. And actor and comedian Robin Archer.
Hello.
How are you, Robin?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. That was fun. We just listened to Class Clown. And I know you're a huge Carlin fan.
Yes.
Well, we probably all are.
I guess. We all are probably in some way or other. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether we know it or not. Mm-hmm. Now, Jim... Jim has been a stand-up comedian since 1979, and he also teaches stand-up at the Second City. You were there at the near the beginning of Yuck Yucks.
Yeah, about a year later.
And you were at the live performance at the O'Keefe Center here in Toronto of the Class Clown.
In 1972, I saw him do the material.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, what had happened, my buddy and I, we used to listen to comedy albums, and we were listening to FM AM in his room back in the day. And he says, hey, this guy's come to Toronto. Let's go see him. And I never even thought of doing that. And so we bought tickets, went down. We're going to see him do the album, right?
Right.
And he came out, and everybody's yelling the bits from the FM AM, do the hippy dippy weatherman or whatever, the newscaster. And he goes, well, I don't like to do the same material over and over again. I get bored with it. And then he went into Class Clown. Everybody applauded. And it must have, I felt like 2 hours. I think it was, and.
So no one had heard any of it before?
No, it was just like, when it got to the seven words, we were just amazed. Like when we're listening to the album, the applause is there, but it was, I recall it being deafening at the O'Keefe Center. Wow. And that was the night after he got arrested in Milwaukee.
Wow.
The night after?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because during the concert, somebody threw a joint up on the stage and he picks it up and he goes, I'll have you know, I'll be going to the police station with this.
So did he mention anything about being arrested, about doing the bit?
No, he didn't. He didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. But I've seen him in interviews. He says he understands. It was an outdoor concert, and there were kids around. So that's he understands the sensitivities of people.
So there was no incident at the O'Keefe Center then. There was
no, not at all, because we're enclosed, and we all paid to see that. So.
And was everyone on board? Was there anyone in the audience that you remember who were offended?
At the very beginning, somebody stood up and left. He started making fun of salesmen, and he called them hookers, and then the same, and hookers were salesmen, and then he says, and then salesmen are hookers, which is the same thing. But,
right.
And somebody got up in the front row and left.
Wow.
And
so probably a hooker didn't want to be
salesman. It was a man. It was a man in a leisure suit. And, maybe he thought, hey, that reminds me. And then...
I've got work to do. So did you, what was your reaction after you left, after you walked out of that place? What was the feeling?
I was 19 years old, and I said, that's the job. That's what I wanted to do. Because when we listened to FM AM, we thought all the jokes have been told in the world. We just didn't, before that, it was always mother-in-law jokes, Alan mm-hmm. King and the old school comics.
Sure.
And this is something new and fresh, and he's close to our age. He was 34 at the time. But he was sort of, as he was self-titled, the counterculture spokesman. And we just thought it was cool. He's got the long hair and the beard and the jeans. He's not mm-hmm. dressed up in a tux or a suit. And it was just refreshing to us. And so that's why when I see today young comics getting into comics that are doing something different, I understand that. You know, if I were a young man, I'd be into that too. You know, so... Yeah, Carlin's the guy for me. That was the job. It took me 7 years, though, to finally find a place to go to perform. And that was Yuck Yucks. And that was my... I mentioned this to Matt in class. I was on 17th out of 19 comedians on amateur night. But I had a routine. I went on stage and I did the routine and got good laughs and good enough to graduate to regular nights right away.
Wow.
So I was able to perform in front of a professional crowd, a paying crowd, about six nights a week. That was my gymnasium. Wow. I was there every night after work, performing as much as possible. And I was headlining in 6 months. The only thing is, back in Toronto in 79, there were only 17 comedians, so there wasn't much to climb over.
So. Yeah, I thought the same thing when you were talking about like getting tickets to go and see him. I can't imagine like thinking about going to a show like that and just be like, should we buy tickets? We'll just go buy tickets.
Yeah.
Instead of like, well, we got to be online at 8 a.m.
Right. Yeah. 6 months before.
Have American Express early access.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You couldn't use your phone to buy tickets back then, unless you actually called someone.
Yeah.
So.
Do you remember any of your best bits from those first few?
For
days?
Me personally, or Carlin? My first bit was a routine on a hockey night in Canada. Danny Gallivan and Dick Irvin and having little fights during the game.
Okay.
And then I would do the three-star announcement with the English-French announcer in the Montreal Forum.
So you're doing characters and stuff. Cool.
But I had I don't know what it was. I didn't know how to do this, but I had the savvy from watching comics all these years. And listening to Carlin tonight with Class Clown, I noticed he's getting a laugh every third line pretty well.
Right.
So he knew when to punch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing that naturally, too. When I was listening, I was thinking back about when I did the Hockey Night in Canada routine. I was punching it. I would do a, somebody would say, I'm trying to remember the jokes now, this has to be the most exciting. Oh, I can't remember the bit now. So
it's a while ago.
I would always do a fact and then punch it.
Hmm.
So Dick Irvin would say, well, Danny, you're right on only one count there. It was the spring of 57, a balmy night, if I recall, but it was not the great Rocket scoring that goal. It was his younger brother, Ron Reed, just breaking into the big leagues. Well, thank you, Dick, you pelvis head. You know, so I knew to come back with something.
Right.
Instead of just continuing on with a straight dialogue.
It has to be a great joke if you make him wait for it.
Yeah, well, so. Not just that. Just an audience really doesn't have that much patience in stand-up. They want to hear, okay, we heard your fact. Now we need to hear the laugh now. Don't keep going with more facts.
Right. That's not funny.
Yeah. Well, they get bored.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you've missed a beat. It's like you're playing a song or you're singing a song and you've missed something, and the audience can feel it. Right. And, I think he's missed something there.
I think often they feel it if you feel it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The audience can smell fear
or
unease. And the thing that strikes me particularly about listening to Class Clown is not everything needs to be a laugh. Not everything is supposed to be a laugh. But he's so at peace with just talking and telling that story that there's no tension in that way. There's no fear or concern on the part of the audience or on the part of the listener.
Well, there were lines there that really on paper don't get a laugh, right? But it's the way his voice, the use of his voice, and that's from his radio days, I guess.
Sure.
And he would alter the dynamics of it, you know, like da 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 da, you know, it's you can hear that he's purposely recording this album to be listened to.
Yes.
And not watched like it is nowadays with Netflix and all the concerts.
Right.
And we would listen to it like 5 to 10 times a week, and we'd have the phrases, you know, let's call the printer. Remember the thing about the dog crap in the window or whatever, the fake dog.
Yeah,
crap.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, buy the refrigerator. All right, thanks. So we'll call the printer. Sure is strange. You know, those little phrases. But when he was ending a bit, sure is strange. And I think he said that with the novelty store, I think. Yeah. And, well, it's a mystery. You know, I love that one in the religion one. Well, it's a mystery. That's the priest coming back at
them. Yeah.
Can't answer that. Well, it's a mystery.
I think one of my favorite lines in the whole album is the thing of like, well, they made questioners out of us.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any answers.
Yeah.
And that's a very poignant line, though, because most comics, we are questioners. And that's how we come up with material. Why is this? Mm-hmm. Or what if we did this? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, and he's one of the first guys to really be bold enough to question religion publicly like that too, and to not be afraid of it. And again, it speaks to that confidence where even the most controversial topics for the time, he does it with such an easy breezy way about him.
Yeah.
And this album sort of goes in and out of that stuff very subtly. Like there's a lot of juvenile humor in this album. Mm-hmm. Like there's probably 5 minutes worth of fake farts and how to do them, and you know he talks a lot about the actual Class Clown and the things that they did, and then but then he starts getting into some subversive stuff about education, about religion, and about the establishment in general.
It's almost like he's trying to subvert your expectations at the top by setting the bar really low, and then when he comes out later with this really heavy stuff, that it's like, oh, there's more here. So
it's kind
like
of a sneak attack.
Yeah, and that's there's a few jokes where I wrote down it's like sneaking stuff in where he's just like, oh, you think this is about something silly like dog poop, but it's actually a subversive comment about American capitalism.
You
know, so it's like it's really like he's really like easing people in, and I think it's because like I'm thinking because it's the audience is so not used to that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still such a novel concept at that time for comics to be like,
that's a good insight because I mean he mentioned the Vietnam War and don't forget a lot of America back then was very right wing. Like we saw the protests, but there were a lot of people in favor of the war because of the fear of communism and the domino effect, and eventually they'd be on the shores of California. And so he's subtly you know coming. He's using the doo-doo caca at the beginning to give them sort of that rhythm that when I get to this stuff, when I finish saying a fact, I'm going to punch it and you're going to laugh even though you're not in favor of this.
Yeah.
That you're not on the left side of the political spectrum.
Yeah, I think there's an element of sneaking stuff in there, but I think there's also an element of I'm going to win your trust with fart jokes.
Yeah.
And show you that this is going to be funny throughout.
Right.
And then with that trust, you're going to trust me and I'm going to take you where I want to go.
Yeah. And it really does carry it throughout. Like, there's never a point in this where you feel uncomfortable with what he's saying, even though he's saying things that should make you uncomfortable. He's talking about controversial things. Like when he brings the Vietnam up, you're never like, oh no, here we go. What's this going to be about? No, he does it with that same easygoing nature, and you just trust that you're going to be okay, and you do end up laughing.
Yeah, because if you're a right winger, and when he says that is what we're doing to that country, you would be upset if that was just said in a conversational setting. And but he's using his voice and the way he says it, and you're just going along with it.
The thing that I'm super interested to ask you, Jim, though, having been someone who actually saw like
the album,
the routine performed live, is the only thing that I find sort of unsatisfying about listening to Class Clown. I found it tonight when we were listening to it, and I found it when I first discovered the album ages ago, is that it's not a constant through line, right? Like, it's an assemblage of bits.
Yes.
There are some obvious edit points, and I'm curious to know how it came together as an actual performance, because we talk about like, this is how he leads people through, but we're not really hearing that full journey.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because
you said it was about 2 hours when you went, right, Jim?
Yeah,
the album's less than an hour.
I'd swear it was 2 hours.
Wow.
The concert. I think now Lenny Bruce was doing the same thing 6 years before him. He had bits. And so I think Carlin picked up on that. So it's not necessarily a theme. Is that what you mean? A through line through the whole?
Well, I just mean like, you know, it's hard to say how
things
say
transition.
Like the Muhammad Ali piece fits into a larger routine, because it's clearly edited into the material there.
Well, I know he later said that he does the heavy political stuff for himself, and he does the dog and cat bits just to keep everybody lighthearted. So he alternates it like that. I think if you went through his albums, you probably would find that.
You know what's really interesting is I listened today to, if I had a favorite Carlin album, it's probably Jammin' in New York. And I listened to that today, and it's inverted, right? Like, in this album, he starts with, like, the Class Clown stuff and the fart jokes and everything. And I think by that time, which was 1991, he's so established in who he is. And you said, like you say, the political stuff is the stuff that he cares about.
Yeah.
He has a built-in audience that now cares about that stuff that he cares about.
Yeah.
The political stuff and the social commentary is all completely front-loaded in that album.
Right.
And then after he does about 10 or 15 minutes of that material, he's like, hey, let's talk about little things that bring us all together.
Right, right. Yeah. I meant to do that.
And that's the sort of stuff where you would imagine, like, in the 70s, maybe he would do that first.
Yeah.
But there's, like, I think you said he's had, like, he's recorded 20 albums.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to be able to listen through all of that and watch the evolution of an artist and also the evolution of how an artist interacts with and has built an audience.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, anytime he's on tour, you know, they're sold out. Well, but getting back to that, in 91, that's when he finally found his voice. So it took him over 30 years to get to that point, you know, but he learned jokes, and now he knows how to apply the mechanism of jokes into his social commentary. What triggered that was in around 87, he saw Sam Kinison, and who was the screamer. And I saw him live, and he's a former evangelist, and it was the most moving performance I've ever seen. I was like staring at the ground for 3 days afterwards. But Carlin saw him. He says, "Yeah, I got to be louder and faster, and just be more forceful. I've got to have opinions. This guy has opinions." And he wasn't expressing that as much. Maybe subtle, like in Class Clown with the Vietnam War. And
yeah. I think he always had them, but maybe didn't just. Think he could hit them as hard.
Which it's interesting though, because towards the end of his career, like I think he tipped over. Yeah. Like he went over, because it was just literally just rants. I watched stuff from one of his last specials, and it's just like he's literally complaining about the things he's praising in Class Clown. He's complaining about education being, you know, open to all and without uniform. Like he's complaining about, you know, some of the same themes, interestingly, like the ecological and commercial behavior in America is still there. Mm-hmm. But it's like, oh, I think he's just really angry at this point, and mm-hmm. I think he's kind of lost that thread that made him so special for so many years. Where he was able to find that balance. Mm-hmm.
I think the sharpness of the thought is still there a lot in those later albums, like Complaints and Grievances and Life is Worth Losing and things like that. But I think that it tips over so far in that the stretches get longer between the jokes.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, like 10 minutes of rant, then a joke, as opposed to like a minute and a joke.
Like I say, I have a ton of love for Class Clown, and I think like maybe the first Carlin stuff that I ever had was, there was an album called Classic Gold, which was collected. It had FM and AM and Class Clown and Occupation Fool on it, which is also great. Occupation Fool has like one of the best openings of any comedy album ever. He gets out on stage and he's just like, "Hey," and he's like, "Well, you don't start working right when you get to your job, you know." First 10 minutes are for you, which is lovely. But I think that like the peak of his career for me, like the albums that are the sharpest and are the best distillation of what I love about George Carlin would be Parental Advisory, Explicit Lyrics, Jammin' in New York, and Back in Town.
Back in Town is probably my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first half hour of Back in Town is just like a complete tour de force.
It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But then, then he almost turns into a beat poet or a slam poet after that, like some of his stuff later on. I think,
With all the bad the cliches, you, all the remember he does a rant on the cliches,
and it's great, but it's a different thing altogether. It's it's like a poem, and it's amazing he can memorize all that stuff. But
I think he had a method. I don't know why I know all this stuff, but I'm a huge fan, I guess.
Yeah.
I remember my son was impressed when I told him the story when I saw Carlin, when that's a job. He goes, "Really?" Because now he's doing it.
Oh, nice.
Anyway, what was my point? I was talking...
memorization.
Yeah. He would read it on stage in front of 3,000 people, but because he's Carlin, they allowed that.
Oh, yeah.
He would have the material, and he would read it for several performances until he finally had it down, and then he would put the full scaps down and then go and do it from his memory, right?
Yeah, I saw Carlin perform at Roy Thomson Hall in Toronto with a notebook, where he was like flipping through the notebook on a stool and saying let's try this one. Like, he was working out bits on the stage at Roy Thomson Hall.
Yeah. When was that, Robin?
2001, I think.
So did that turn into a...
Oh, yeah.
What was it?
Yeah, you could then... I don't remember the exact album. Okay. It would be maybe You Are All Diseased or maybe Complaints and Grievances. I'd have to check.
Amazing.
Yeah,
he... A very prolific writer, sure. You know, he just wrote down things and he knew how to turn it into a joke. He always knew the jokes needed to be there, no matter what point he wants to make about something.
Yeah,
and that's what some of us don't realize sometimes. There are things that tick us off and we want to talk about it, and a lot of us, we don't have the training or the experience to go, well, where do I go with this? You know, how do I turn this into a joke? He, when he died, because he had like 20 albums, Sirius XM, the comedy channel, just played Carlin 24 hours, and I don't think anything was repeated.
Wow.
You know, so there's that's the goal you want to get. And he was working out stuff in concert because he was working towards his next HBO special.
Right.
And what I find so impressive about his body of work too is it's something that's always in motion. Like, you listen to that first album, it's very straight men in suit sketch.
Yeah.
Very constructed.
You mean the Burns and Carlin.
The Burns and Carlin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then FM and AM is 50-50. The first half is the stuff for him. It's his new, he's finally figured out, and I've listened to the memoir of his daughter, and like, she talks about how he realized, no, I don't like the Indian sergeant. I don't like the wino radio and all these characters. I want to tell my truth.
Yeah.
So he does that album, and you can hear it's like there's a distinct break between those two sides, and then comes Class Clown, and it's like in every album, it's like he never stopped learning and he never stopped adapting as an artist, which a lot of comedians don't do that. They find their happy place, and then they stay within that box.
Well, and that's what makes it interesting to me is like a lot of Carlin fans have different favorite albums. Like I was reading earlier, like, what are the different eras of Carlin? And some people try to make it as simple as young Carlin and old Carlin. But, I mean, it's almost like every album is its own era. Like mm-hmm. you can distill it into that moment in time and how he's affected by that moment in time, what he wants to talk about, how he wants to talk about it, how he's feeling, what drugs he's on. Like, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
that's kind of fascinating.
Well, he was constantly reinventing himself.
Yeah.
Like by the end of the 70s, he was a parody of himself. Mm-hmm. He was fading out almost. Yeah. And we all, you know, because I think even Rick Moranis was doing
yeah, that. Yeah, there's that SCTV.
There's no green wine.
And apparently he was like really upset by that.
Was he?
Yeah. Like just he was like, because it was a realization that he is a caricature of who he was a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm a joke now. And that drove him to change even more. It drove him further to create and be more unique.
Just a thing about Class Clown again. That's probably my favorite album, even though I haven't listened to it in 45 years. It's because I had it burned in my head after listening to it 100 times. The credits on the album on the liner notes is thanks to Leonard Alfred Schneider for taking all the chances, and that's Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, right.
And that's really who his big influence was. Just he saw that this guy has opinions, and he's doing this, and that's where he wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt because he was 30 at the time, he was sort of in between like the 40-year-olds and the 20-year-olds, and he wanted to relate more to the 20-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's how that came about.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that Lenny was such an influence on him, because I feel like he became closer to Lenny much further down the line.
Mm-hmm.
He was much more accessible than Lenny for the average comedy fan. He was less the... sort of a lot pontificator,
less,
you know.
Yeah, a lot less confrontational.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the cadence is there. Like there are moments on that on that album on Class Clown where I'm like, "Oh, I can hear just that flow." And I mean, maybe it's because they're both like New Yorkers who grew up in the same kind of, you know, melting pot of influences, but there's just that sort of like how he breaks into a voice here and how he leads into a joke there. I'm like, I can hear it. But I mean, like he's emulating a like an inspiration and a mentor,
but very much more laid back.
Yes.
Like
yeah.
Lenny had a very kinetic, like caffeine, like sort of energy to him. And Carlin definitely had an energy too, but he embodied that hippiness around it.
That's the thing. Like I find interesting about, especially during this era of Carlin, like he feels very laid back and chill. Mm-hmm. And like, you hear like the mountains of cocaine that he was consuming at the time. Yeah. I don't get that when I listen to it. It's like you think cocaine-y 80s comedians, like, oh, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just, he's very like chill. He's very like.
I think it was probably more LSD in this particular time.
Around this time, like he was.
I thought coke came a little later.
He and his wife were both doing it on a daily basis.
Really?
Yeah.
It was around in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And it was considered safe.
Yeah, because like, it wasn't illegal. Right. It was just a thing that people did. And like so apparently his wife at this time was like going into rehab and stuff. Like she almost died from a mix of Quaaludes, cocaine and alcoholism.
Yikes.
So it's like just a crazy like and so it's like I don't hear that at all. Like it was just interesting. Right. Like it's just like there's a commitment to his material where he's like, okay, well, this is my drug of choice, but that doesn't get in the way of my performance, which is interesting to me in a way.
Well, yeah, do we know if he was ever high during any of these recordings?
I don't know.
He looked at the one he did in Arizona in the theater in the Round.
Oh, yeah, Carlin on Campus, I think?
Glazed over. No, I think it's after that one.
Is it after that?
Okay. Before or after that one, but it's he's just
I know the recording,
in a circle, and I forget the bits from it,
and
I don't know if I've only seen the video. I don't know if I've listened to the album or not on that one. I probably did, but I just remember his eyes just really...
Yeah.
I want to say the album is playing with your head over. Or something.
No, I think that was even later,
was
too.
Even
but you could see that he was...
Yeah, when you watch the video, you go, wow, that guy is really
but
stoned.
But you
really?
Never, if you list, just close your eyes and listen to the material, you don't hear it.
Yeah.
You don't hear, like, his voice is... His voice coming through his jokes is so clear, and it's so realized. It's just astounding.
Actually, now that I think of it, it was HBO. Because there was a disclaimer at the beginning of the show, a woman disclaiming about or talking about how Carlin has he's using words to make a point and things like that. And Yeah, I just it looked like, is he going to get through this? You know.
Wow.
Sorry, Jason. I think you had a point there, but
oh no, okay. I rarely do. I fake it.
We'll edit that out.
I think one of the most, like you said, he's got a lot of eras to his career, mm-hmm. but I think one of the key things that he carries through all of those, like maybe not the Burns and Carlin era, but beyond that, I think he has an amazing ability to sound unrehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And to sound really authentic, and yes. to sound almost like this is a one-sided conversation, and all of these things are occurring to him in that
yeah.
moment.
It's, and he always sounds like he's calling out BS to me too. Mm-hmm. I feel like mm-hmm. that's a thing that is always
like from
through that.
Even from his early sketch
Very
stuff.
Genuine.
It was all about hypocrisy. It's mm-hmm. all about hypocrisy and commercialism, yeah. and that rings through from the beginning of his career to the end of his career. Yeah. Like that theme.
And
it
you,
between all of it.
Because of that feeling like almost off the top of your head, it feels like you believe everything he says is what yeah. he feels about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you don't always get with comedians. You often mm-hmm. see, oh, okay, I get your joke. You clearly don't believe that. But like, there's nothing Carlin says that seems like he just wrote it to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's what he really believes. And that is so engaging to be able to put forth an opinion and make you think about it, but also make you laugh at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's what the best comedians do. And I think he surpassed Bruce very early on.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
With
yeah.
that.
But I think because he seems believable, I think it's his training. He wanted to be an actor. And
yeah.
so,
right. Well, on the radio, he'd have to be personal with people too. And connect
also,
with people.
But acting is all about emotions.
Sure.
So, you have to believe what you're saying to mm-hmm. own the words, even if the words are written by somebody else.
Wasn't yeah. it Danny Kaye who was?
That's who he wanted to
he
be.
He wanted to
yeah.
be Danny Kaye.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like,
yeah.
I got my Danny Kaye plan. I'm going to start on radio, then I'm going to do comedy, then I'm going to become an actor.
Yeah. I can't think of like two more opposite energies, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I know he had the goofiness, Carlin, but the goofiness to me always felt put on.
Yeah.
And sort of what he said later
yeah.
on too spoke to that. Like he always seemed like he was more comfortable with the guy with a bit of a chip on his shoulder and calling out, like you said, hypocrisy. But Danny
yeah.
Kaye was like the most innocent seeming performer you can get. So
yeah,
goofy.
He wanted to be Mr. Entertainment.
Yeah.
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 But that's how we fall into things in life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be a stand-up when I saw him. That was the goal. But, and I did it, but I didn't get to the fame that he had.
Sure.
And that was fine. I got to see the country. I worked at all the Yuck Yucks, coast to coast to coast, and that was the job I wanted. I was happy with that. I didn't need to push to go further.
Right.
I didn't need the heartache when it failed.
And did you start, like, did you feel like you were trying to emulate him or his style, and
yeah,
it took
I think
you a
I
while
a
to find your own? How long did it take you till you were really you?
Probably maybe a year or two.
Yeah, okay.
You know. But again, I like jokes, so I just tell jokes, one-liners.
Huh.
And, but that even took maybe 7 years to finally
wow.
do that, because I was doing sketches off the top. Like I said, Hockey Night
yeah.
Canada, I would do a news parody,
right.
and I would have a ticker tape. Back in the day, we had ticker tape, and so I had that running in the background as I'm doing the bit.
Right.
And which was a great vehicle to try out new material, because you were allowed to sit and read like a newscaster would. So I'm on
right,
stage and
right.
just reading new jokes, making them sound like a news item. And then, the Ku Klux Klan was recruiting in Newfoundland today, and tragedy struck the Klan members when they were mistaken for baby seals. If I get a laugh, okay, that's in the act now.
Right, yeah. That's a check mark.
Yeah.
I know with my own pursuits of comedy, like I sometimes find it hard to focus because as a fan of comedy,
yeah,
I want to do voices, I want to do bits, I want to do stories, I want to do sketches. And like, did it take you a while to sort of focus to find that what you like is the one-liners?
Yeah, well, I kept refining it because when you first start out, you just try everything.
Yeah.
And you keep doing it over and over again, and then you start to realize, okay, that doesn't work, so that's gone. And it just gets tighter and tighter.
And did you find, just because something didn't work, it wasn't necessarily the material, but how it married with who you are, like your persona?
A little bit of that, but yeah. I think it was more the material that I was too wordy.
Mm.
I didn't know how to refine a joke, really. It came to me naturally for the longest
right.
time. And
did you ever improv up there?
No.
No.
Not on purpose. Only when I had a heckler. But because I came across as likable, I would always win usually. Whoever right. said anything, I would just, I wouldn't even think to try to be funny. I would just repeat what he said and then and comment on it. And right. a lot of times it would get a laugh.
Cool.
Just don't panic, that's all.
Right.
Just mm-hmm. just take it in. I always repeat what a heckler says to make sure everybody else sure, in the room hears sure. it. And it gives me a few extra seconds that's to it. Think of a comeback.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Robin, I remember the first time I saw you do stand-up,
yeah.
and it really surprised me, the style that you adopted. It was good, and it was funny. That's not the part that's surprising. But, you know, you in life, I know you pretty well, you're a fairly soft-spoken, maybe that's not quite the right word, but an even-keeled guy.
Sure.
And I think I would, maybe you think this is unfair, but I think I would describe you as an angry comedian.
Definitely at times, yeah.
Yeah, and like, I didn't know you could talk that loudly. Like, and I was really surprised, because when I talk to you and you make jokes and asides, it's very wry and sarcastic and dry. And, you know, you weren't quite Lewis Black or anything like that, but it was definitely a couple notches up from where mm-hmm. you are. And was that a choice you made early on, or like you must have been influenced by Carlin? I know you're a huge
absolutely.
Fan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like particularly influenced by that louder, angrier period.
Mm-hmm.
So that was certainly something that I brought to it at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that that I was at first was, I think you made reference to like not improvising on purpose up on mm-hmm. stage. Mm-hmm. I was intensely scripted.
Right
off yeah. the top, like to the point where,
like cripplingly so.
Not cripplingly, no, mm-hmm. but like to the point where if I said on stage, was written in a Word document somewhere.
Wow.
Right. Like.
Wow.
I knew the meter of things and the way that I wanted things to go,
mm-hmm.
And I would write them out, and then that's generally how I would perform them. And
wow.
I got away from that by there was a couple of years where I hosted theater sports, so I would do stand up off the top of the theater sports show. Every Saturday, and it would be basically the same group of people coming to see the theater sports show every Saturday. So it just got to a point where it was like, it's impossible to write a new
right.
5 to 7 minute set
and memorize
every
it
week
perfectly.
And memorize it perfectly. Right. Like yeah. it would be like, I would be on the subway on the way to the Bad Dog Theater, and I'd be like, what am I going to tell jokes about tonight?
Like, really?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it wasn't improvising like I didn't know what I was going to say when I got up there, but it was, I got to a place that was a lot more free form. And now I've,
wow.
I think there's sort of a synthesis
right.
there, which I feel good about.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I have at times tipped over into too angry, like
mm-hmm.
into a caricature. So
right.
I really try to kind of pull back on that.
Interesting.
And find a place for that, but also find a place for like the sort of laconic aside.
Well, that's what I was
going
to ask
yeah.
you too. Like, yeah, do you? It's neat to hear an ebb and flow to stuff too, and it
mm-hmm.
surprises people if you come out with energy that wasn't always there. You have
yeah.
a reason for it, as opposed to it's just your persona all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll have to come check you out a show.
Yeah.
Sounds like you've changed.
Yeah. the really interesting thing about like getting back to Carlin and about that like 20 albums, you can see. You can see him evolve as a comedian, but you can also, like, if you listen album to album, you can see the evolution of specific jokes. Like,
mm-hmm.
You can see him figure something out. There's
right.
a very specific example of it on Parental Advisory, Explicit Lyrics, and Jammin' in New York, where on the former, he's talking about war, and he's like, the rockets and the bombs and the bullets are all shaped like dicks. I don't understand that, but it is part of the equation. And then in the next album...
Yeah.
He's figured it out, and he's got a joke for that.
Right.
Which is really cool. And you can see it also in, like, FM and AM and Class Clown, where, like, FM and AM has shoot his shit with two O's, and then
right.
that clearly
yeah.
evolves into
seven words
you can't see on television.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Occupation Fool has a further extension on that, which I think is called Filthy Words.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he talks about adding to the list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite parts about that is when he said, you're allowed to complain about being pissed off, but not about being pissed on. They'll bleep that part out. I think
you know,
that's fantastic.
And the thing is it comes from him getting fired in Vegas.
Yeah, these are real words that
like,
will really get you in trouble.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's
yeah.
like he kind of has to thank that casino for
mm-hmm.
creating
yeah.
the most... like his definitive.
Well, it was a huge court case too.
Yeah,
with the not the FDA, the
FCC.
But it was the FDA was had very little to do with
it. So it was like ultimately he paid a lot of money per performance for because he's opening for the Temptations, I think it was. Or something
Right.
When he got fired, and it was like he was like they bought a house with the money from like his weekly paychecks in Vegas, and it's like, but it created possibly one of the most important jokes of his career.
Yeah.
In a way.
Oh yeah. And in comedy, I mean, it is just so iconic, this whole idea. And those words you still, for the most part, can't say during prime time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's added to them as time has, as we've added filthy words to the lexicon as well. I can't remember what the newer updates were, but I think he was on the Tonight Show in the 90s saying there are a few more words.
I believe it's fart, turd, and twat.
Forgot about that. Yeah,
I love that they're all funny words, too.
Yeah. Well, the thing, I was a young man. I was 19 when these albums came out, FM and AM, and FM, AM, and Class Clown. And it was just unbelievable to hear the word shit or the seven words heard in public when you're in a place you know there are rules that you're not supposed to say these words in public. So that it's very risque to us at that age, you know. Yeah. So, and it's just, it seems like comedy got more and more extreme from that. It started there, and then each generation that came along tried to push the envelope a little bit further, you know. And like, Yuck Yucks, for example, was very successful in the early days. There was no alcohol sold there. It was a coffee house.
Oh, wow.
And so on a Friday and Saturday night, it was filled with 17-year-old kids from high schools.
Oh, wow.
Because they would go back on a Monday morning to school and go, it's great. It's not like TV. There's swearing going on, you know.
Yeah. I just love how much he really thinks about every single thing that he says and every single thing that carries through all of his material.
Like, he never feels like a guy who went like, oh, that's a good joke.
Yeah.
And then that's all he does on that subject. He exhausts it. Mm-hmm. And in very clever ways, like really deep dives on it. And I loved the, I think it was in the New Yorker after Carlin died, Jerry Seinfeld wrote an obit. And the sort of the theme to that was Carlin did it. And he said, you know, we would sit around and talk about, oh, what about a bit about this? And they'd say, ah, Carlin did it. And way better than we could ever think about it. And then he said, and of course, like, you know, we're all sitting around wondering who's going to die first. And Carlin did it. That was kind of the end of the obit. But it was neat to see how much he revered him and how he had covered so many things. And like, it's interesting to me, Jim, that you said you heard that FMAM album and said, well, every joke's already been done.
Yeah.
But then he tops himself. Like, there's just, it's limitless what you can joke about, even though it feels like, well, when someone puts out something that good and that exhaustive, that it's done.
Well, that's,
but he kept proving wrong just himself.
Well,
he
like
kept
I say, I thought every joke had been done. And then I see him do Class Clown and went, that's the job. So there's more jokes to be written.
Right.
You know, for me, I was such a fan, but I purposely avoided doing what he was doing. I went the other route, maybe old style one liners.
Right.
But I was doing it. You know, I was just happy that, you know, I just didn't want to copy him because that's all I'll hear for the rest of my career.
Yeah. Sure.
He's just Carlin.
Well, I mean, I think it's he's almost so omnipresent that you could charge any comedian with copying him at this point.
But it's like, so Lenny Bruce kind of not created, but he forged the that seed of confessional comedy.
And like
that,
you said,
that personal perspective and that rhythm and
energy.
Stuff. But Carlin made it accessible to everyone. And I think, and then from that, you know, you get all these other comedians kind of growing out of that. And I think, you know, I think mainstream comedy owes a lot to Carlin now. The older school, like Borscht Belt kind of comedy is gone effectively.
Yeah.
And you know, that indie alt, what we label alt comedy now was what he was doing. And
although I would say, what's the new in town? Mulaney.
Don Mulaney.
I would say Mulaney has some flavor of that old school kind of.
He does, but it's a veneer.
Yeah, there's a sardonic spin on it for sure.
It's a deliberate choice too. Yeah. Which is like, he's like, okay, this is the voice of the day. I'm going to create something that's a distinct brand.
Yeah. Very different. And I like it because it's not quite the caricature that some people do. A lot of people make fun of vaudeville for like a bit, but I feel like Mulaney almost embodies it.
Yeah.
And it's just uses modern sensibility.
It's honest.
It's very earnest.
Yeah. And he comes across that way, but he's got a very dark heart, and it's great. The jokes that come out of that earnestness.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, in that we're sort of like reached the point where everything, like Carlin's legacy has become so pervasive. Now we're having people turning the other way and creating comedy in a voice that's sort of in that men and women in suits and dresses and that old fashioned sort of sensibility to cut through the noise.
Yeah. Which was still part of his stuff in the beginning. Like it's interesting how his voice kind of got distilled, like being brought up by people like Bob Newhart and Nichols and May. I mean, I'm sure is stuff that Carlin was listening to. And you know, when you listen to Burns and Carlin, it's very much that thing.
And John Burns, he was like part of that first Second City crowd. Him and
Jack Burns?
Jack Burns and
Robert Klein?
Avery Schreiber.
Avery Schreiber, yeah, that's
like
they,
his partner afterwards. They hooked up at Second City and you know, Mike Nichols and Elaine May were part of the birth of that as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's like this stew or these different voices.
Yeah. I love that era because you can hear the old school sort of cheesy stuff that's still very much in the structure of what they think comedy can be, but you can hear that modern sensibility just sort of bursting, wanting to come out, and then Carlin just sort of
threw open the doors for everybody.
Yeah,
yeah. It's like Lenny took all the chances and Carlin picked up the ball and ran with it. He knew how to sort it out and make it mainstream, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I think he made it funny. I mean, I don't think Lenny Bruce is the funniest guy. Mm-hmm. I respect him, and he, like you said, he took chances.
Yeah.
And but what he did, like you said, is just, oh, we can do whatever we want. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now I've got stuff that people will actually laugh at because it's controversial, but I can write it better than the stuff Lenny was doing just for the shock value.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although I still love some of that cheesy old stuff. I think the album we did, the Bob Newhart album, the Button Down Mind of Bob Newhart, is to me one of the greatest.
Is that the one that has like the
Abe Lincoln? And
it's all one sided phone conversation.
It's like the driving instructor and things like that.
That's the thing with Bob Newhart. Hey, Bob Newhart, I think, is like Seinfeld, because there's this bit that Mulaney talks about how Seinfeld is way darker than people realize. Whereas Seinfeld has this bit about going to the theater, and when he's done in the theater, he's got his drink in his hand and he just lets it go because that's not his responsibility. The people who work there, they're there to clean up after him, which is a super dark concept. And I think Newhart was sort of like that too. And I think that's that through line of like, you're working in something that on the surface is just completely, you know, completely straight and completely innocuous and completely welcoming, but there's that little dark scene. And and watching Newhart's material, like his TV shows afterwards, all the way up to the finale of the
Newhart
where it calls back to his first TV show in strange
way. He wakes up in the Bob Newhart show, I think.
In bed with his wife from the first show. Right. And it's like, that's like so layered and so well thought out and so dark in a way, because it's like, these people didn't exist. You know, they're like all these like seasons of people. They were a figment of his imagination.
It's also very gutsy because there are many people who never even saw that original show. I watched Newhart with my family, but I'd never seen the Bob Newhart show. That alienates so much of the audience.
Yeah.
It's amazing that the network let him do it. Just such a 180.
Which is why it's so, I think the contrast of Carlin versus, say, a modern voice like Mulaney is so interesting, because they're both able to take similar themes and just approach them in such different, distinct ways.
And they subvert it for the time. They subvert it,
yeah, in different ways. And it's like, but and they both have value. And they both, like, mm-hmm. Carlin ages well. Like, you listen to his albums, mm-hmm. for the most part, they you laugh at all of them.
Yeah.
Lenny Bruce, we did Carnegie Hall, the Carnegie Hall session. And
that was a slog for me.
It was I'm like, when I put it in context, I'm like, oh, I see what he's doing here. Sure. So I can intellectually deconstruct a joke.
But it's not time.
But I'm not laughing.
No.
You know, so, yeah, and it's,
I think people were laughing because they were surprised more than anything.
Yeah.
He was jazzy.
He was very jazzy. He was a beatnik.
I think there's a thing about a lot of Carlin's material over the years that, like, maybe more than any other comic that I can think of, where you listen to it now and you're like, oh, is he talking about now? Do you know what I mean?
Like, America the Beautiful, like, Australia's on fire. Yeah. That song is almost prescient.
Sea to oily sea.
Yeah, it's like completely relevant to now. And like almost all of his albums have at least, like, I would say all of his albums have at least one joke, if not an entire album that it could easily be coming out yesterday or tomorrow.
So many of his political observations are still very relevant.
Like I say, I listened to Jammin' in New York as well today, and there's a thing in there where there's a bit about entropy and entities. Like, you can see the fabric of society just now beginning to come apart at the edges and the seams, and I'm like, he knew.
Is that the one where he's talking about the earth and it just flicks us off like fleas?
He's like, the planet is fine, the people are fucked.
Saw him do that bit live at the Pantages.
Oh wow.
And how many times have you seen him, Jim?
I think I saw him three times, and then I was going to... Oh, four times. So, the O'Keefe, Roy Thompson, Pantages, and Casinorama.
Over how long a period of time?
I think every 10 years I would see him. Wow. It was one of the... I didn't plan it that way. It just happened to come out that way. And I did have tickets for his next thing at Roy Thompson, but he got ill and canceled. The next year he passed away.
Wow.
So I would have seen him five times, I guess.
Wow.
And he just always had it, you know?
And I mean, the thing with Carlin too is he loved it. Like, he was performing up until the week before he passed.
Yeah.
This wasn't just a job. It was a job, but it was a love. And you can hear that, I think, in his material. The care he puts into how he crafts his material is not somebody who's like, I'm doing this because this is my career path. He's doing it because he loves speaking his truth.
Well, and this makes me wonder too, back to your point, Robin, about how you wrote even the ums. Like, I'm curious how, I mean, later on it's more obvious that he wrote everything to the wink, like when it gets into almost poetry type of stuff. But I wonder how many of his bits were written word for word and performed word for word. Because it seems necessary for them to be performed exactly the way he does them, but they're performed so naturalistically. And I know some of the best comedians do that. They write it the way they talk and they do it the same every time, and it's baffling to me how real that sounds. Eddie Izzard did a surprise show a few years ago at Comedy Bar. There's only like 60 of us in the audience or something. It was amazing. And my friend Ian McIntyre, he went to both shows. I think it was him. Someone I spoke to saw both shows, and they said it was pretty much exactly the same. But he feels so ranty, though, so tangential. How do you say that word?
Tangential.
Tangential. I know that's how it's spelled, and I never was comfortable with saying it.
You learned something new. Tangential.
Hey, I don't feel I belong here when I heard sardonic earlier. I'm out of my league.
But, he sounds so tangential. Tangential. God damn. And you swear, it's like, where was I? Anyway, blah, blah, blah. But like, people would say he did it exactly like that in the second show. Mm-hmm. And that stuff blows my mind. So like, almost fake. It still sounds so genuine, but you're almost faking that you've lost your place.
And it's hard because there's, I'm forgetting his name. He does a show on Netflix and the BBC where he goes around to places with his father, who's kind of British and racist.
Okay.
Kind of.
Traveling with my father.
Yeah. So I saw him a couple years ago at JFL 42, and I was like, oh, this is, I watched his bit, you know, because I had the pass and I got the refunded token and all that jazz. And I'm like, oh, this is fine. But then I watched this. I'm like, oh, Jack Whitehall. And then I'm like, oh, I'll watch his special. And it was exactly the same, but it felt wrong. It's not like Carlin or something.
I had that experience. This is going to be crazy, but I had that experience seeing Robin Williams the last time he was in Toronto.
Oh.
Yeah, I went with my dad and we saw Robin Williams at whatever the O'Keefe Center was called at that time.
Hummingbird Sony Center.
And it was amazing. Like, it was an amazing show. And then at the end of the summer, he did that same show live on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched that performance, and it was the same performance, but it didn't land for me at all.
Just too rehearsed. Maybe.
I don't know what it was for me with Whitehall, but it's just, it was like, there's like ad-libs, quote unquote ad-libs, that were not ad-libs, which is fine, because that... You ad-lib something in the moment, and it's like that landed really well.
Yeah.
I want to carry that through, but it felt stilted. It felt just wrong.
So, Jim, did you remember when you saw? I mean, when we listened to Class Clown Upstairs, he did a bit where he made the swallowing sound effect, and you were like, "Oh, that sounds different than when I saw." Was there anything else that you felt was not exactly?
No,
as it was
not
in the album?
Really. And that's the thing. Just getting back to Robin, for me, watching Carlin do that before I got the album. Then I listened to the album, and I just felt like it was back at the O'Keefe.
Mm.
So it didn't bother me that I'm hearing it word for word again. That's what I wanted to hear.
Sure.
And that's a lot of that's a big problem with a lot of audience members. I've had people come up to me after the first show, and they went, "That was fantastic. We bought tickets for the second show. Oh my God!
Oh, no.
What are you doing?"
Woody Allen said, "Like, you don't write a new act right in 2 hours." So no. Woody Allen had said that. That happened to him, and he said, "Why am I concerned about that? My act is an act. It's a play, you know, and I do it the same every night."
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't go to a Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and then see the second performance and expect different dialogue.
Yeah.
No.
So it's a piece of art. And so like Eddie Izzard, he's just working that out, getting it polished maybe for his... TV special or something.
Yeah.
So it's a bit, it is disappointing to see them do the same stuff.
It's not even a disappointment. I expect it. I mean, I know enough about comedy that I expect that, but is there just some people who are able to achieve it? And Carlin is one of those.
Yeah.
It's like it never feels stilted or faked. It feels genuine every time. And I can listen to an album a million times. I could watch a special a million times, and it feels fresh.
I think that's a skill, though, that isn't talked about a lot.
He's able to discover it in the moment every time.
That genuine, like sort of what you're saying before, Jim, you have to be able to be an actor. You have to find that emotion again and find the excitement and what you need to deliver the joke properly.
Yeah, for me, I was just happy that I knew I had an act that worked anywhere in Canada. And so I was just, this is fantastic. I can go on in front of 200 strangers and make them laugh. Brent Butt even said to me, he says, "Man, when you're on stage, you're like the happiest guy in the room." It's just because I'm in my zone. Nobody can touch me.
I don't know if that's a compliment, Jim.
No one else was laughing, Jim, but you were having a great time. I didn't even notice they weren't laughing. I had the best time.
The joke was, "What do you mean? They're on their feet and walking and walking out the door."
Gentlemen, what do you think is, it's a crazy question, but a modern day equivalent? Like, who is someone who, I mean, someone younger than, say, Seinfeld? I think Seinfeld is probably the most obvious passing of the torch, but...
You think Seinfeld is the passing of the torch from Carlin?
Well, I mean,
it's funny, because, like, when you said that he wrote the obituary, I'm going to search that out and read it, but I always... when I was younger, like when I was consuming Carlin albums in the 90s and Seinfeld was doing Seinfeld in the 90s, I always saw them as like diametrically opposed.
Well, I mean, Seinfeld definitely doesn't have the anger in most of his material, but I think the sharp eye for observation.
Yes. Yeah.
So, the exhausting of a topic.
Now, when I go back and I think about like what Carlin was doing in like 81, like A Place for My Stuff, that's very clearly evolved into... the Seinfeld observational comedy rubric.
Yeah.
I always felt that Seinfeld was Carlin in a suit.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. You know, that's a great way to put it.
And almost he found a way to really, he'd have an observation, but he knew how to make it an even stronger punch and tags.
Mm-hmm.
And Now, mind you, when I listen to Class Clown tonight for the first time in years, I can hear him with strong punches at the end and tags. So for a long time, I felt Seinfeld was just a guy who figured out Carlin and then knew how to add something more to it.
Right.
You know, because Carlin used to have observations like, you ever notice the handrail and the escalator goes a little bit faster than you do?
Yeah.
But then there was nothing after that.
Yeah, he would just move on to another observation.
Because it was new. We're all sitting there going, I've noticed that, right? Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard this? Where are the good scissors?
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, then nothing doesn't attach to anything. But yeah, Seinfeld was good at making a whole bit around something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He rejuvenated airplane material. I mean, his whole bit about the little bathroom on the plane and the Wolfman shaving. Fantastic.
Well, it's interesting how, you know, in the 90s for me when I was doing stand-up, if you were doing dog and cat jokes, you were a hack, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But now there's no such thing as being a hack. Bill Burr does like 9 minutes on the pit bull that his girlfriend brought home.
Right.
So there's dog material. So it's all about you finding an angle and an emotion to attach to it.
Bill Burr is an interesting name to bring up because he's sort of an angry blue collar kind of guy, anti-establishment. I'm not the biggest fan, to be honest.
Nor am I.
He's a little inflammatory for my taste.
Takes a while to get used to him. But
Like he's when people joke about like beating their wives and kids and stuff like that stuff for me is a little it's hard for me to laugh at, but yeah, he's probably a similar. Mm-hmm. Energy, maybe.
Well, who would you say is?
I mean, there's. If you'd asked me a few years ago,
Louis.
I might have said Louis C.K.
Yeah.
But I have always, always had this relationship with Louis C.K.'s comedy where, like, 50% of what he's doing is the thing that I love most about comedy and the thing that I look for when I go to consume stand up comedy. And then the other 50% of it is 100% not for me.
Yeah, he tends to ruin himself often.
Yeah, like even if
vulgar and
Chappelle is a bit like lazy. That. For me
even
too.
If you go back to like his earlier stuff in like you know the mid 2000s, it's like 50% amazing observations about you know life, and the other 50% is him shitting on his wife.
It's lazy vulgarity,
which I don't like at all.
No.
Sometimes literally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think if if I had to choose somebody, it would be Patton Oswalt.
Yeah,
because like Bruce begat Carlin, Carlin begat Hicks, Hicks begat Patton. They've literally in each case they're like people who
I feel like
had Patton's... interactions and had like inspired and mentored one another. So there is an actual physical through line, but also I can hear. The pop culture zeitgeistiness of Patton, the observation, but especially now, like early Patton, Patton now. Post like
he's
his tragedies.
And...
Well, there's sadness there. There's before it was like, my kid's gonna throw my Blade Runner gun on the roof.
Yeah, let's talk about Star Wars.
Yeah, and... that's funny, but that's funny in like a hyper nerdy specific way. But talking about like losing your wife and raising a daughter. And finding love again is like these deep resonant themes that are Carlin-esque in their universality. Mm-hmm. So I think I wouldn't say 10 years ago Patton, even maybe 5 years ago Patton, but Patton now, I think is an avatar of that same kind of truthfulness in your comedy that Carlin was.
And does that come back to what you, I think you said it earlier about being confessional?
Yes.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Please go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say my observation about confession, sometimes it's just people are just up there and just confessing, but there's no joke to it.
Well, that's the thing. That's the talent
that
Carlin has and that Patton has is there's still a joke there.
Yeah.
And some people don't recognize that or understand that, but both of them knew, I still need to make people laugh. It's not just they're not paying me to be like for me to use them as a therapy session. They're paying me to make them laugh, and they remember that, and that's I think the trick, and that's where I think that connection comes from.
The other name that I would say, who is you know maybe a little bit younger, who I forget about and I shouldn't, is Mike Birbiglia.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I was thinking about him earlier when Jim was saying, you know, you like one-liners. And I was saying how the audience, it has to be a great joke for the audience to wait for it. Mike Birbiglia has such a slow pace sometimes, mm-hmm. and such confidence in his story, and he will make you wait. And sometimes it's not a joke. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's not a laugh. Sometimes it's a heartfelt yeah. thing. It's a sadness or something. Mm-hmm. And he's just a master storyteller. He's in a class by himself. Anyway, you were
yeah no I agree
back
with,
up your point,
I agree with everything that you said.
Yeah, like yeah. He's I haven't seen the new one, which I think is called the new one.
Nor have I. come over and watch it.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's his confidence to be able to go that long without a joke, knowing that he's got them wrapped yeah. in his yeah. story is fantastic.
I think one of the greatest examples of comedic storytelling is on Thank God for Jokes. There's that segment in the middle about, it's the Catsachusetts segment, which is just brilliant.
I'm not sure I remember that. It sounds ridiculous.
I'm not going to try and recount it here because yeah. I can't. But mm-hmm. Basically, he says, like, me and my wife were going to Massachusetts and we called it Cassachusetts, and that's
it just
funny.
Goes on too
it's
long.
Just a stupid joke. And then it's like, it's a 10-minute long thing that has a turn at the end of it, mm-hmm. and it's hilarious, and it's also beautiful.
Awesome.
Yeah. I think it just comes down to Carlin's gift to comedy was honesty. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. it just is being true to yourself as a artist and a comedian and the human on stage, and you, whatever that truth is, if that truth is I want to play a character and enjoy playing that character, then that's that truth. Or it could be a confession, or it can be any mix thereof, but I think he was yeah. one who, like, he bridged that gap that
I think, though,
creators
he's it's a little bit more specific in him that he never felt to me, even though he's goofy, he never felt self-deprecating.
No.
He always felt like the voice of authority to me, like that he knew what he was talking about. Yeah. And like there wasn't really an option to disagree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in a non-paternalistic way. Like,
and yeah, he was
an authority without being an authority.
In a non-authoritative way. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
He just was
genius.
Like, let me just tell you the truth.
Yeah.
To call back to my material, yeah. a weird uncle.
Yeah, I feel like
that actually came to mind as you were talking about it.
I wonder if, like, Bill Murray would have been that type of comedian. I feel like he would have, if he was a stand-up, he would have
yeah.
been Carlin-esque.
Yeah. Well, I think
laid
maybe
back
eventually,
at first, then angry later.
I mean, like, he was a very angry young man.
True.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, I think now he'd be Carlin-esque, but I think it would have been a very different journey.
I think it might have been the opposite for him. He might have started where Carlin ended up and then became mellower
as
he aged. Who knows? Anyway, gentlemen, this has been a real treat. Thank you for joining us for this.
Yeah.
Thank you to, as always, Matt Ardill, producer and future current host of the podcast. I'll talk about that in a second. And thank you to Jim McAleese. Did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
Right
and,
on.
I'm looking forward to next week's podcast where we review the best of Myron Cohen.
If you say so. you could find Jim McAleese at various comedy things happening in town. He also teaches at Second City, and you could find him on Facebook. Thanks to you, Robin Archer, for joining us. I'm glad we worked it out. I know you're a huge fan, and it was great to have your insights.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. And you can find Robin on Twitter at All Things Robin, R-O-B-I-N. And he does various shows across town as well. I'm Jason DeLine. This is my last show as host of Comedy Album Book Club. It's been a pleasure to listen and talk about many of my favorite albums and yours. And now it's time to bring in some new blood, new passions, interests, and knowledge. Matt will be taking the reins, and I'm excited to see and hear what he does with the show. I appreciate your support, and as always, thank you for listening to Comedy Album Book Club.
This podcast.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.